Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Adventures in Machine Learning, a podcast where we nerd out about ML, AI, data science, you name it. This week, we have a really special guest, an author who has written a number of books that try to explain incredibly complex topics to, I wouldn't say it's just a young audience. I found your samples of your work to be very fascinating, and sort of distilling down these complex topics into something that is approachable for a layperson, but also for kids to get them excited and really explain through the topics. And we have you on the show because you did a topic on our world. So yeah, let's get into it. I'm Ben, one of your co-hosts, joined by
Michael Burke. Hi, everyone. Glad to be back.
And Catherine, if you could just introduce yourself.
Yes. So I'm Catherine Hulick. And as Ben said, I write about science and technology for kids mainly. And I've been doing that for over 15 years now. I started out writing for some kids magazines and went on to write. I'm a journalist mainly, but I've also written books, educational books, as well as, books you might find in a bookstore, aimed mainly at kids in middle school and high school, but a summer for a little bit younger. But yeah, you can find me. My website's CatherineHulick.com, and I'm on Twitter at KHulick.
Awesome.
Hey, folks, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs. And lately, I've been working on actually building out Top End Devs. If you're interested, you can go to topenddevs.com/podcast, and you can actually hear a little bit more about my story, about why I'm doing what I'm doing with Top End Devs, why I changed it from devchat.tv to Top End Devs. But what I really want to get into is that I have decided that I'm going to build the platform that I always wished I had with devchat.tv. And I renamed it to Top End Devs because I want to give you the resources that are going to help you to build the career that you want, right? So whether you want to be an influencer in tech, whether you want to go and just max out your salary and then go live a lifestyle with your family, your friends, or just traveling the world or whatever, I want to give you the resources that are going to help you do that. We're going to have career and leadership resources in there, and we're going to be giving you content on a regular basis to help you level up and max out your career. So go check it out at topenddevs.com. If you sign up before my birthday, that's December 14th. If you sign up before my birthday, you can get 50% off the lifetime of your subscription. Once again, that's topenddevs.com.
And I was wondering just how one gets into writing kids' books, especially about technical material.
Yeah, I mean, I knew I wanted to be a writer from a very young age. I used to, from as long as I can remember, I wanted to be an author when I grew up. So I'm lucky that I got to do what I dreamed of doing. And figuring out that I wanted to write for kids was actually the first thing I realized out of college. I was looking at some kids' magazines, and I'm like, I could do this, and I really want to do this. I just love how curious kids are. I feel like when I was 10 years old, I really didn't want to get any older. And some part of me, I don't think really ever did. I just kind of really connect with the questions kids ask and how curious they are and how excited they get about things. And that's why I like writing for them, because they're just a great audience. And I started out, I did an internship with a kids magazine group, and I got to know the science editor really well. And that's actually how I got my first published piece, is I wrote for her. And I wrote for that magazine. I still write for that magazine group, actually. And once you have a few things published, it's a lot easier to get more things published, because you can send those out and, people see that you can do it, and they'll give you more work. And actually, science writing for kids, it's a pretty niche area. There's actually quite a lot of demand for it. So I've had really steady work. I write for Science News for Students. That's an excellent online resource for teachers use it in their classrooms, but parents can use it too with their kids. They just basically write about science news, but aimed at a young audience. And I write for Muse Magazine now and Front Vision, which is a Chinese language publication. I don't have to write in Chinese. They translate it, thankfully. Yeah, so I write for a lot of, and I've done a lot of books. This is my most recent book, Welcome to the Future. So this is about all different kinds of technology and how it could change the world in the future. So I open each chapter with a science fiction scenario, like superintelligence ruling the world is one of them. There's robots doing everything for us is another one. And then I go into, is that actually possible? How might it be possible? And then what do we actually want to happen? That's really the heart of the book, is what do kids want for their future? What are the ethical implications of some of these technologies, and how can we make sure that they're beneficial to everybody? So this is the book that just came out in November 2021. So that's the one I'm most excited about right now.
So writing about the superintelligence /
yes.
The general zeitgeist seems to think people that aren't in this field equate the term artificial intelligence with that sci-fi superintelligence. Yes. So you say in the intro to one of your chapters where you're like, hey, coming into this, into writing this book and tackling these topics, yeah, I had this conception of what I thought this was. And then you went through the process of learning it and getting a deep understanding of, oh, this is actually what this is. And it's not what people are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what that process was like? I mean, you've had to do it, obviously, for 15 years, learning new complex topics in order to explain them to a novice audience. But I really want to hear what that process was for what Michael and I do.
Right. Right. So I've written about tons of different science and technology topics, you know, everything from AI to robots to space to biology and medicine. But AI really is where my heart is. Like, that is where I started getting into this. Like, as I wrote in my piece for The Gradient, I picked up Gödel, Escher, Bach when I was in high school and just, like, I never looked back. Like, I just have, like, devoured every popular science book about AI and robots for as long as I can remember. So, I mean, for me, that is really what I keep coming back to. And that this book, actually, originally I wanted it to be just about AI, but I couldn't quite get a publisher to go for that. So I wound up adding a lot of other technology in there too. But for me, I mean, I have been learning about it for quite a long time. I have never been a developer myself, though, so that makes it a little harder. And so I have made some assumptions along the way that I've learned later were wrong. And I guess the big one for me was a lot of people like to compare neural networks to the brain, and they're called neural networks. Like, they have artificial neurons. So I mistakenly understood for a long time that it was a lot more based on the brain than it really is. Like, I just didn't realize how little people actually know about the brain, first of all. So if you even wanted to build something like the brain, you don't even know how to do that because you don't know how the brain does what it does. So there's that side of it. And then there's the other side of, like, can we even build something like the brain, even if we did know how it does what it does? Because, you know, we just may not have the right hardware or the amount of computing power to do that. So there's just such a disconnect there. You know, I thought that we were building these things that were a lot like the brain, but just maybe not big enough yet or not complex enough yet. But in fact, it's worlds away. And that's something that I try to get across now whenever I write about this, that yes, we may call them neural networks, but they're not neurons, and they're not really like the brain very much at all. It's like a loose inspiration, but that's not what it's doing. And I guess the other thing that was a really important realization for me was that they're not even learning in the way that a person is learning. Like, yes, it's called learning, and it is learning in some sense, but it's not understanding. It's not able to put together concepts in the way that people do, or any biological brain does. Like, probably even my dog can learn things better and in a different way than an AI model. And figuring out that it's a pattern matching statistical technique is really what helped me make that leap. Is like, you're taking this data and you're matching your new data to your old data. You learn a whole bunch of data, you do all this statistical magic on it, and then you can match new data and be like, okay, I've seen this before, and here's what it's most similar to, and we're going to pop out an answer based on that. And so once I kind of grasped that, I was able to explain it a lot better to my audience, why it's not a brain and why what it's doing is so different from what you're doing when you learn something or think about something.
Yeah, I've had that topic of discussion with people before, of people in business who are like, hey, you said you built this thing to identify what things are in a picture. Mm-hmm. And why can't it learn this new thing? Mm-hmm. Like, doesn't it understand?
Yeah.
We're from the outside looking into this field of study, humans want to personify everything.
Yes.
It's just how we socially work. So we can think of this thing that seems intelligent because it can do this one task, arguably, particularly for image classification, if it's trained well. But yeah, like you said, it's not smart. It just optimized itself well for that mathematical function that it's trying to calculate.
Right.
And it's the reason I asked that first question about learning the process is because that's a technique that some of our listeners have to go through as working as a data scientist or an ML engineer in business and industry, is going through that discussion with an executive, explaining, hey, this is what it can't do, and here's an analogy to use. I'm straight up going to use some of the analogies in that chapter of yours that I read, because I think they're great about explaining what this actually is.
Yeah.
And it's definitely worthwhile to have a conversation at that level instead of saying down way too deep into the tech weeds that the audience won't get.
Right. And I really think that that's what I can offer to, you know, developers out there, is a way to think about this and talk about this that will help people who aren't experts. Like, because a lot of times when you're in the weeds of doing this, you don't realize what people don't understand or what people need to understand before they're going to really be on the same level as you. And I think that's yes, maybe I write for kids, but what I write is also accessible to anyone. And honestly, what a lot of people misunderstand about writing for kids is they think that you have to dumb things down or explain everything. And that's really not it at all, because kids are really, really smart. They just don't have as much experience in the world. And they're also way less patient than adults. So the real key to writing for kids is to keep their attention. You got to keep it interesting. And that's really the key to communicating with adults too. You've got to make it not just interesting, but relevant, like relevant to their world. Like, what do they care about? You've always got to think about what your audience cares about. And I don't really know what executives care about, but maybe hopefully you guys do if you're talking to them. But you know, you got to figure out what they care about. And that's where you have to kind of focus your energy. So that's, you know, some of the analogies that I use when I'm talking about AI with kids. You know, I try to think about things that are relevant to them. I use games a lot, like the AI that have been trained to play games, because that's something that's interesting to kids and they can grasp. You know, I do talk about the brain, but as I said, I'm very careful not to compare AI to the brain too directly. But that is another way that you can help understand, you know, what's going on here. But yeah, that's what I always try. Keep it relevant and keep it interesting. That's way more important than making it simple or dumbed down or whatever. And I hate that phrase because I don't dumb things down.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And I've seen so many technical people try to present technical topics to non-technical people. Mm-hmm. So engineer to a stakeholder, and they can throw math on a slide. They can throw whole paragraphs on a slide, like, and just pace poorly, use the exact same tone of voice. There's so many presentation tricks that are super useful when presenting and keeping people's attention. And also, you made a really good point about ensuring that you're providing value. A lot of people don't really care. It's sad to say, but like, we find it really cool. And also because we have so much context into this field, because we use it all the time, intricacies are relevant and valuable. But oftentimes people just want to know the outcome. And they don't really care how it works. Like, will it help me? Will it hurt me? And when and how? So I think that's a really good point about providing value to non-technical people.
Yeah. And the thing I always say is you've got to be passionate about it yourself. Like, that's catching when you're really excited about something. Like, I always, when I'm starting a piece, I think about what makes me say, wow. Because sometimes I have to write about things that I find boring. AI, I don't find boring at all. But sometimes I know, like, I had to write something about I don't know, when I have to write medical stuff, I don't find medical stuff that exciting, but sometimes I have to write it. And it's like, I got to really think hard, you know, what makes me say wow about this? And when I find that, that's when I can start writing. Like, that's because I've got to be excited about it myself. If I'm not, my readers are, they're 12 years old. They're going to go off, you know, and they're going to be on whatever it is now, Twitch or whatever. they're going to be gone in seconds. They're not going to stick around. So yeah, I need to be excited myself in order to get them excited and keep their attention.
Yeah. And that shouldn't be hard. This field is pretty awesome. And it's moving very fast. Mm-hmm. Like, 5 years ago, it was completely different from how it does now.
Yeah. That was something that was exciting for me, writing the chapter on AI. DALL-E came out while I was working on it. And I was, you know, I had actually written in my chapter that, you know, AI can't combine concepts to like create something new. And then I saw DALL-E and I went on and I was like, hey, I can make a penguin made of carrots. Like, it can do that. It can take this this bizarre phrase and it can draw that. And I'm like, well, I got to change that sentence in my book because, you know, now it can do this thing that I thought it couldn't do. And it blows my mind. And I mean, even though it's not understanding anything, I still think some of the ways that these computer, you know, minds, to risk giving the wrong idea again, the way they work, I think it's so different from how human minds work that it actually can help our creativity. It can make us more creative and more capable in so many ways. I don't want that to be a negative thing, that they work so differently than the brain does. Like, I want to get kids excited about that this is they have a lot to offer us by thinking about things so differently. Like, one of the DALL-E images, it was a shark playing chess. And I noticed that, you know, I think most people, if you ask them to draw a shark playing chess, they'd put the chess pieces in the shark's flipper, like, because that's its hand, right? But some of the pictures that DALL-E drew put the pieces, like, had like the shark hovering over the board with its tail, like it was playing the game with its tail. And I'm like, well, maybe that would be a more natural way for a shark to play. And one had it like with its teeth right up next to the board. And I'm like, well, maybe that would be more how a shark would play. And those are things that a person might not think of, but the computer did, because it doesn't have these concepts that we have about how hands work or how chess works. So it can do things that are really out there that might make us think differently about the world.
And I've found that extends not just to interesting cutting edge things like that.
Yeah.
Like, applications like that are really fun. Mm-hmm. And people have done, like, hey, I want to create art based on thematic. Like, I'm going to feed in an image that has nothing to do with this particular epoch of art that's been created and generate a picture of my dog like Jackson Pollock would paint it, and it'll spit something out. That adversarial network will do that. And those are cool. But those insights about what you said that really resonated with me, and something that I've had a conversation with business before and stakeholders is, hey, we can gain insights in ways that we can't think. And that's one of the selling points. Statistical inference of, you know, one of the most powerful algorithms that has come out over the last 15 years for business to customer. And you see it on websites everywhere now, or different implementations of it, which is alternating least squares, which is if you have Netflix, you're very aware of this. Yeah. When you start viewing stuff, and as you have your account for a longer period of time and you start watching certain things, there's a fun little game that you can play with this as well. If you do that, create an alternate account on Netflix and select just a bunch of random stuff over a period of about 2 months, and then compare your landing page between that random selection. You only have to watch maybe a couple of minutes of something. Mm-hmm. And then compare it to your main account and see the difference. Those recommendation engines, and Netflix isn't just using ALS anymore, but that was the precursor to do all that stuff. But having that conversation with the business about why this is important and how we can't actually conceptualize how to do this ourselves because of inherent biases that we have. If you're talking about, okay, marketing team needs to create the recommended for you. And 20 years ago, early days of the ideas of this, people were doing that handcrafting stuff like, oh, this, we have 100 cohorts. We're going to create 100 recommendations every day. And here's what we're going to send out. And humans built those. And they were generally terrible. Mm-hmm. And you apply massive matrix factorization on a ludicrous scale, you can get these per user recommendations. But the important part of that is it's not just the end result that you get value from. You can also look at that data and look at how the algorithm, I'm doing air quotes right now, but air quote thought through that problem.
Yeah.
Even though it's not thinking, it's just utilizing its internal structure to say, hey, this is who our customers are.
Yeah.
Maybe this is what programs we should be creating for Netflix. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what Netflix does.
Right.
That's how they determine what their internal things are going to be. It's like, what do people like most? What are the things that rank highest on these features that we've created?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of like interesting things.
Yeah, there's a lot to learn from that. And that's actually another thing I use a lot talking to kids about AI. I love the example of the recommendation engine, because that's something that people interact with every day. And many people don't even realize is AI, because they think of it as the pop culture, like robots and stuff. And Siri maybe is AI, but like they don't realize that it's in there, like in the things that they're doing in the background, selecting their search results, and that their search results are different from someone else's, or selecting their book and movie recommendations, and that those are actually, you know, tailored to you based on your behavior. I mean, that is another thing that I love to use as an example, because it is so relevant.
Yeah, one challenging thing that I've noticed with training those recommendation engines is you can optimize, often you're optimizing for a specific metric, and humans tend to have external context that helps you think about what is a good metric, what is a bad metric. And one of the things that I've personally seen recommendation engines struggle with is metrics that have latency or that are not directly impacted right out of the gate. So if you reconfigure the Google search results, for example, to increase click-through rate, for instance, how does that impact retention a month later? That's a really hard training exercise just due to the lag. And I think that's one thing that would be really cool if algorithms got better at, is sort of taking external context, taking a priori rules, and leveraging those in the training as well. And there's a couple of cool methods that we've actually talked about here. But yeah, recommendation engines still tend to be just straight up optimizations. And they don't, as you said, they don't contextualize, they don't learn, they don't have concepts in their head. So in their air quotes head. So hopefully that's something that will be being developed in the next, coming years. But I just thought that was an interesting point, that the lag in results can be really harmful for training.
Yeah, and I think some people have tried to solve that with, I've seen some implementations using LSTMs in order to build, like almost ensemble the recommendations in a way that you can create that time lag effect. Like, hey, if the recommendations that we're producing over time, are we exhausting our audience? Are they just seeing the same sort of thing? Mm-hmm. Do they get bored? Are they going off to search something else? And then you see companies trying just dozens of A/B tests. I'm like, okay, let's try this idea. Let's try that idea. And that, unfortunately, that is the state of our world. And yeah, Catherine, one thing that you brought up earlier that has always fascinated people, like when I explain to, say, like my parents, they're like, well, what do you do? I'm like, well, I do data science and ML engineering. And they're like, oh, you mean like just do all that fancy stuff like Netflix? I'm like, well, no. It's everywhere throughout business.
Yeah.
If you're a consumer in today's world, I think most people would be very surprised just how much machine learning impacts their lives in ways that people probably wouldn't expect. Everything from making sure that your favorite snack at the grocery store is in stock. That's an algorithm that's figuring out how many to ship to that store at what time and what day, and when do they need a reorder, to when you go for a pre-approval on a car loan and you get that instant feedback like, yep, we're going to give you a loan. You can get this car for $45,000. No problem. That's an algorithm. When you're looking to refinance a house or apply for a mortgage, that's all algorithms. Humans come in the loop later on, but that first pass of yay or nay, that's all algorithms. And yeah, it is recommendations on Amazon. Like, they have some pretty sophisticated ones, but it's everywhere.
It is.
It really has taken over the world.
Right. Yeah.
And does translation that scare kids?
For better or worse.
Does it scare kids?
Does that scare kids?
No. Yeah. Kids are, they're totally fine with all of this. I mean, they're growing up with it, so they're not scared at all, honestly. Like, it's a kind of a weird thing. Like, as I get older, I get a little more disconnected from their world. But in general, these things definitely don't scare them the way that they scare grownups. I think because they're growing up with it, it's normal to them. And they don't have the same sense of like privacy being invaded when their life is out there on social media. It's very different, I think. And I'm getting a little scared because I have a 7-year-old, and when he gets to the point where he's online all the time, he's not going to have the same kinds of ethical, maybe, concerns that I do about that. But yeah, no, they're really not that scared by it, as far as I can tell from from what I've done.
So one thing that you did mention in this book was about bias.
Yes.
And what are your thoughts on that? From having studied this from not a practitioner's point of view, but from an enthusiast point of view for so many years.
Yes. I mean, honestly, I think that that's where our fears about AI should be placed. Like, not in it taking over the world or turning us all into paperclips, which are, you know, the more exciting ones that you might you might hear in popular culture. But I think that if we actually want to be afraid of something about AI, it is the bias, like the fact that, you know, we're making these automatic processes that can do so many things for us. But one thing that they do is since they don't have any concepts or understanding, they're just repeating the data they're given. And if the data they're given is biased, they're going to repeat the biases. So that is definitely an area of concern. And I think that it's something that, you know, everyone working in this area should keep in mind. And one of the people I spoke to about this was Ayanna Howard. And her point, which I think is a very good one, is that if you want to not have bias, you need to have the people who are building this stuff be diverse, because that's the best way to make sure that, you know, they're taking everyone's needs and concerns into account. Because if you don't have a diverse team of developers or stakeholders or whatever, they're not even going to notice, because they're not going to realize that maybe this is slighting some population or some community because they aren't of that population or community and won't even necessarily have, even if they're not even trying to make something biased, they might do it accidentally just because they aren't, that population is not included in the process and isn't, their concerns might not even be, they might just be invisible, you know? So I think a lot of times that this happens, it's not done on purpose. It happens accidentally because the people who are building it are just not aware that there is this opportunity for bias in the data or in how it's being used or how it's working. So that's another way that diversity and inclusion can hopefully help reduce bias in the future.
I would double down on that and say that no data set that reflects any human construct is going to be free of ethical biases.
Yes, that's probably
anything
true.
That is a reflection, except if we're talking about content recommendation on a streaming platform, probably no ethics violation there, provided that you're doing age filtering for recommendations. But if we're talking about the serious stuff that should scare some people, which is like, hey, if we're talking about a state figuring out what funding is for a police force in regions of different cities and about where they need to deploy officers and patrol vehicles. And then that linking to the perception of a region being economically disadvantaged, therefore reducing the property values of that and further segregating people based on race and national origin and culture, there's this interconnectedness to all of these things where our own flawed society mm-hmm. and the way that we misinterpret the proper levels of equality in society and egalitarianism forces these algorithms that ingest that data to continue to propagate that. And I think that what you said is very important about getting that diverse perspective to think about a revolutionary chain-breaking event when you're building something that can influence reality. If it's something that's funding police and or it's approving loans and estimating home values in a region, if you're doing algorithm work and you're building these solutions and people are going to be automated systems are going to be consuming it, you can be the inmate running the asylum.
Right.
And you can break that chain.
Mm-hmm. There's an important misconception that if it's technology, that it's somehow not biased. Like that's a misconception that's out there that we need to help get rid of, that if it's a machine, like it's not going to have, like if you feed this stuff into a machine and it spits out an answer, that it's going to be fair. Like that's a misconception that's out there, that like a person can have a bias or a prejudice or be racist or sexist or whatever it is, but that a machine can't be because it doesn't have those preconceptions. Like that's a misconception that I think is out there and is hopefully changing, because mm-hmm. it's definitely not true, because people built the machine and people gave it its rules, and it might not be following the rules that you want it to be following. Even if you think you built it fairly, it might not be acting fairly.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs. And lately I've been coaching some people on starting some podcasts and in some cases, just taking their career to the next level. You know, whether you're beginner going to intermediate going to advanced, whether you're trying to get noticed in the community or go freelance, I've been helping these folks figure out how to get in front of people, how to build relationships, and how to build their careers and max out and just go to the next level. So if you're interested in talking to me and having me help you go to the next level, go to topendevs.com/coaching. I will give you a 1-hour free session where we can figure out what you're trying to do, where you're trying to go, and figure out what the next steps are. And then from there, we can figure out how to get you to the place you want to go. So once again, that's topendevs.com/coaching.
From a philosophical standpoint, it seems like there are three options. The first is, A, we have an unfair world and we should continue using that unfair data in our algorithms. The second is figure out some method to make the algorithm completely fair. So for example, let's say we have race as a predictor in our police dispatch algorithm. We can treat every single race equally. And then the third is try to correct for the societal biases. Mm-hmm. Which do you guys think is the correct path?
In algorithm development, it's incredibly important to remove data that identifies systemic biases in society. So if you have an algorithm that doesn't actually have to do with biological, you know, gender assignment, don't put that in your algorithm. Mm-hmm. Like it shouldn't be a feature. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the point? Mm-hmm. It's there could be a strong signal there, but that can be the signal that you don't want,
right?
Because it's just perpetuating something that is unfair. What should we offer the salary for this person for this position? If you put gender in there, you just wrecked the system. You're going to continue to say, oh, well, women accept salaries that are 20% lower. Why is that? It's because that's what they've been offered. Because a lot of business is misogynistic. Let's stop doing that because it's stupid. If you have something with race in there, I mean, I can't imagine, unless you're working for the UN, why you would ever need to analyze that in a model. So don't put that in there. So I would remove all of that. But also another thing that's incredibly important is if there is a signal that is tied to that and your problem is working on that, exactly as you said, Michael, like figure out a way to deweight that to level the playing field so that when you do an analysis of that algorithm, you're checking through and simulating behavior with sort of seed state and saying, okay, what if I have this as my features coming in that's sent like a sensitive a row of data effectively. Does it predict what I think we should be predicting? Or is it something that if I read an article on this in the New York Times, I would be outraged? If it is that, then don't do that. Yeah. Like fix the model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it would depend on the situation as well. Like it depends on the context of what you're using this for. But I like everything you were saying, Ben. And I don't think we should accept that society is unfair. I think everyone has a responsibility to whatever you're working on, keep that in mind and try to make it more fair and more just be cognizant of the fact that this is out there. And this is something that even if you don't think what you're working on has anything to do with these biases, it may.
Yeah, Ben.
And that's why I think your book is so incredibly important for people. I mean, I hope it gets super wide distribution, yeah, honestly, so. Because as you said, kids these days are, like my own kids included, like they're growing up as this being just this, the state of reality.
Yeah.
AI has existed since they've been alive. People have computers in their pockets that are far more powerful than what the US government was running on 50 mm-hmm. years ago. And since that's the norm, it's important to understand what these things are and not accept that popular culture explanation of it, but really understand, like, how do these things work and yes. what are they actually doing and how does that impact my life and how can I respond to that in a good right. way?
And I wanted to give kids ownership of their future because it's not just something that happens to you. It's something we create. I mean, that really is the point I want to make in the book is that we are creating the future. And even if you don't become an engineer or a developer or a scientist, you may become a policymaker or a writer or or someone who influences popular culture towards one way of thinking or another. Everyone has a voice that's important. So you got to at least have a basic understanding of what these technologies are and what they're doing in order to have an opinion on it that's relevant and important and make your voice heard.
Yeah, completely agree. And another point is that people tend to be scared of and don't trust things they don't understand.
That's true.
I have a friend that develops algorithms for parole boards. And yeah. when trying to explain technical concepts to people who work on the parole boards, aka judges, it's really hard. And if they don't understand, it leads to lots of problems and them just not using the algorithm, even if the algorithm will be more correct. So right. I think being able to communicate these complex topics and increasing digital literacy is super important.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like it's exactly what you're doing. So thank you.
I hope so. That's what I'm trying to do, is increase that technical literacy. Yep. Yeah. And critical thinking skills. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like you could have an entire very worthwhile, successful book just on this topic we've been talking about of ethical AI for the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So think of anything, like understanding the base technology is important.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of if you were to take somebody from the 19th century and show them that, hey, we don't use horses anymore. I mean, we still have them.
Yeah.
They're cool animals and people like to ride them. But when we get around in these other things, we call them cars, and they would look at it and be like, I don't see where you store the horse, or mm-hmm. like, how does this thing work? Mm-hmm. What do you mean you pour like lantern fuel into this thing and it just goes?
Yeah.
So, which is even more, it'd be even more crazy showing them an electric car and how that functions. But if you're dumped into something with no context, it just seems magical and it seems like you're powerless to do anything about it. So I think that's really important, but as a foundation, but understanding that how important ethics is in making an increasingly more automated world, more like the world that we all hoped we lived in, is important for kids to sort of understand that, like, hey, I can control this mm-hmm. or I can do something about this, either through building or through just being a citizen of saying, hey, not okay with this. We need to change the way that this works.
Mm-hmm. Another one thing you said just made me think of something else, that when you're talking to non-technical people or kids, is to be very cognizant of not speaking down to them, of not making them feel ignorant, because that is a danger as well. That really turns people off. Like, they're scared initially, you know, if it's something they don't understand, but I think what they're scared of is being shown to be ignorant or being shown to be not good enough or something. And with kids, I mean, kids are used to that. Kids are used to not knowing, and they're very comfortable with saying, I don't know, and asking questions. But adults, I think, are much less comfortable with that. So I think if you are communicating with adults, you need to be very aware that they may not understand you, but not feel comfortable saying that. So I think that that's something where you've got to be careful that you are establishing, you know, an equal relationship with them. You're not trying to be all high and mighty, like, I get this stuff and you don't. You got to be super careful that you're connecting with them in a way that's going to make them feel equal and feel like they have something to share and something to add as well, and make them feel comfortable saying, I don't know. I mean, it's hard for adults to do. It's thankfully easy for kids to do, but it's harder for adults. And I think that if you're trying to really connect with someone on these types of topics, they got to feel comfortable saying, I don't know, and asking for more information.
Yeah. I was wondering if either of you guys have tips for communicating to non-technical people? I know Ben has communicated plenty of incredibly complex topics to me, and they all make sense. So he has a ton of knowledge in that, and Catherine, you write books about it. So yeah. I was wondering if you guys had general just guidelines for how to communicate these concepts.
I do, actually. I actually recently gave a talk to MIT because one of my chapters in my book was about fusion energy, and the fusion energy scientists were super excited that I was explaining this to kids. And so they actually, one of the person at MIT asked me to talk to their students about how to communicate fusion energy to non-technical people. So so I did that. And, you know, it's the rules are the same, whether it's fusion energy or machine learning. And I can read through some of the tips I told them. Some of them I've already talked about, but the first one that I told them and that I told you guys as well is to find your passion, find your wow. Like, what makes you say wow about this? Get yourself excited, because that's going to get your audience excited. My other tip is to open with a hook. So that's journalism lingo. That's very related to finding what makes you excited. So once you find what makes you excited, that's where you start. It doesn't matter if there's all sorts of background stuff you think you have to explain first. Start with the exciting thing, and then you can go back and explain if there's anything that needs to be explained. But yeah, you want to start in the place that gets you excited and is going to get your audience excited. Paint pictures is my other piece of advice. That's to use sensory language, which is weird in science, but it does help. Talk about how things look, sound, smell, taste. I mean, and that's where the metaphors come in, like comparing things to things that are tangible, to things that you can experience in your life. That really helps when it's possible. It's not always possible. Machine learning is an area where it's a little less possible maybe than fusion energy. but if you can do it, it does help. And then relate to your audience. We already talked about this a little bit. What matters to them? What do they care about? That's what you need to talk about. They don't necessarily need every bit of background information that you think is important. They need what they need to know. And then using action verbs. A lot of technical writing and communication has passive voice. And if you don't know your grammar, that's okay. The passive voice is like, this algorithm was designed by X. And active voice is X designed this algorithm. So active sentences are just much simpler and easier to understand. They don't sound as academic, like the passive voice is really, I think, what makes academic writing sound academic, but it also just is boring. So whenever possible, try to avoid that. It's like a grammar thing, but it really makes a big difference. It really does. And just using interesting verbs, like trying to avoid just has and was, and using things like just using good verbs like spark or astonish, or I don't know, just verbs that make people see things, have mental images in their head. And then my last piece of advice is to simplify. And again, by simplify, this is the hardest one. I don't mean dumb it down. I mean to use simpler sentences to talk about ideas one at a time instead of trying to explain a bunch of things all at once, and to leave room for questions. Like I said earlier, you know, you want people to be able to feel comfortable asking questions, and you don't need to include everything. You don't need to include every last technical tidbit, just what is most essential to get your message across. So yeah, that's my advice on science communication.
Yeah, I'd say that that's shockingly similar to what I would recommend for communication to executives.
Uh-huh.
The only thing that I would swap the place of two things when talking to executives for data scientists, which is number one and number three.
Oh, okay.
Number three that you said is the number one important thing in business communication to executives. You have to tell them why they need to care about this.
Yeah.
And if you're not speaking and presenting a project idea or an explanation of how a project is doing in the terms of what they care about, i.e. money or productivity or efficiency, that's for executives. But if you're talking to an internal team or a partner company that you're interacting with, every bit of communication from somebody of extreme technical acumen in this space, leave all the implementation details, as we say in software development, like leave all that to the side. We'll talk about that if we have to, but that can be a follow-on conversation one-on-one with somebody who actually cares. But when talking to a room of people, when I do it, I leave all of the technical talk off the table. It's irrelevant for the audience. Mm-hmm. So it's more like, hey, this is what this thing is actually doing and how it's going to improve your life or your business or your profit margin or whatever it may be. And then when you say those words about like, hey, based on our analysis, we think this is going to increase sales by 15 to 25%. All of a sudden, you just got the attention of everybody in the room. And if they ask questions, if they're like, hey, so how does this work? And then I go down this Maslow hierarchy of complexity, but only if people ask about it.
Right.
And if if somebody really wants to go down into the weeds, I usually just tell them, like, hey, let's meet after, like, just you and me, we'll talk about that. Because you don't want to lose, just as you were saying, Catherine, with the simple sentence structure and simple ways of presenting not too much information. I think that's important in talking to people in meetings as well.
Yeah. And I think one thing, I actually have to cut technical detail out of my writing a lot, because when I get into the, you know, really into my research and really into understanding this stuff, I'm really excited and proud that I figured it out and that I, you know, I know how it works. And so I want to put that in there, but then my editors are like, well, you know, hold on, you know, maybe we don't need to put all this in there because it's just going to confuse your readers or it's just going to be too much. So yeah, I do end up having to cut technical detail out a lot just because I have to learn it. One thing about the simplify is you have to know it super deeply and well yourself in order to do a good job at simplifying. That's kind of a non-intuitive part of it, is that you, I mean, as a writer, like, I have to understand this stuff really well in order to explain it to kids. Even if my explanation seems really simple, to get to that, I had to do a lot of work and a lot of research. And I'm not going to be able to do a good job simplifying it unless I have understood it really well and really thoroughly myself. So that's something that's important.
Yeah, there's an acronym in software engineering, ELI5. Explain it like I'm five.
Yes, I know that one.
And it's shorthand. If you look in, you can go to any open source repo on GitHub that's actually active and is maintained by contributors. Mm-hmm. And if somebody does a proposal, files an issue, and they say, hey, I have this great idea I want to implement this new feature for this API. And you look through it, and it's just this wall of techno babble. Or just incredible complexity. And you'll see one of the maintainers of the repo just do a one-line comment at the end of this 10, 15, 20 pages of text. It's just capital E, capital L, capital I, five.
Yep.
And that's it. Mm-hmm. And that's the litmus test of that person who proposed this. Like, do they actually understand what they're asking for? Sometimes it is sort of passive aggressive when people do that, because it's like, hey, cool that you explain all the technical details, but can you actually explain what you're building? Because if you can do it in three sentences, then we know that you know what you're talking about.
And it's really hard to do. And honestly, it's why I have a job, because I mean, I'm good at it. And I talk to a lot of scientists who are like, how in the world are you going to write about this for kids? And I'm like, don't worry about it. That's why I'm here. You know, like, that's apparently, I don't know. I've got a knack for it, but it's really hard. And if you don't have a knack for it, that's okay. You know, maybe you're not the right person to be doing this kind of communication, or maybe you should work with someone who, you know, take some classes to improve your skills. But it is hard, and it does not come easily to most people. So it's definitely something that, if it doesn't come easily to you, practice it and maybe get some people on your team who are better at it to give some pointers or give some help. Because yeah, it's not easy for everyone, and it's okay if it's not easy for you. It's definitely a skill and an art in a lot of ways.
Yeah, could not agree more. I have a blog that I do, and in every blog I have a technical TLDR of like two paragraphs that summarizes the entire post. And that thing takes me the same amount of time as the entire post. It's always so hard to condense.
It's really hard. Yeah. I have to do that for all my articles I write for Science News for Students. I have to write like a 2-line web summary, and I hate writing that thing. Like, I just detest it. And I'm pretty good at it because I've trained these skills for a long time, but I still hate doing it. It's still really hard to take everything you're thinking about and put it into two sentences. It's super hard.
I'm kind of curious. Yeah. It's just a personal curiosity, but after having read the chapter and the topics that you talked about, I mean, I read a couple of chapters from the book, but when you're learning this stuff, how deep did you actually go? Did you like, hey, I'm going to take an open source data set and I'm going to build an algorithm and I'm going to do validation?
No, I'm not. I did never actually programmed anything. My programming skills are very awful. I'm definitely not able to make this stuff myself. I mean, I guess the main thing I learned from is interviews. I call up people who know what they're talking about, and I talk to them and I ask them the questions of the things that I need to understand. And I am definitely not afraid to say, I don't get it. Please tell me, because that's what I do all the time in my job. So I did interviews. I interviewed people who have written books about AI. I interviewed people who are working on it. I found resources online. I read a lot of books. I mean, that's how I did it. I just talked to people who are building this, who do have the expertise, and I asked them the questions that would help me get to a point where I could understand it.
Did you want at any point to actually do that? To be like, I wonder if I could do this.
You know, it's a funny thing. It's like, I love learning about science, but I've never really wanted to do it that much myself. I'm not, I don't know. I just don't have that inclination to want to make these things. I really love learning about them. I love learning what they can do. But yeah, no, I haven't really wanted to build them myself. I guess maybe, I don't know. That's always been, at one point I did consider maybe going back to school for cognitive science. This is before I even became a writer. But again, I mostly wanted to learn about like how intelligence works. Like I didn't really want to make things that would be used in the world. I was really curious about like how does intelligence work and how can we maybe model it in machines. But I guess I found that just learning about it in general and then explaining it to others to me was a lot more interesting than making it myself. And I just love that I get to learn about so many different areas, not just this one, that I get to learn about fusion energy right. And I get to learn about space and even medical technology. So that's been my favorite part of my job. It's just that I get to learn about something new every day and then share it with other people.
That's awesome.
Hey, folks, if you love this podcast and would like to support the show, or if you wish you could listen without the sponsorship messages, then you're in luck. We're setting up new premium podcast feeds where you can get all of the episodes released after Christmas 2020 without the ads. Signing up will help us pay for editing and production, and you can go sign up at devchat.tv/premium.
And it's definitely not for everybody, can confirm. But what do you think about the fact that the books that you write and the audience that they're targeting, that you could be inspiring 500 plasma research scientists who actually figure out how that tokamak can retrieve criticality with net positive output? And all, you know, like somebody reading that book could eventually go on and be like, I'm going to make the next version of ITER in the south of France. Mm-hmm. And we're actually going to achieve clean energy.
I mean,
like, how does that make you feel?
That makes me feel amazing. I mean, that's why I'm doing this. Like, that's honestly, like, that was my dream. I mean, when I was 8 years old, I wanted to be an author. And I didn't dream of writing science books, but I'm glad I did, because I think that they make such a difference in the world. Like, at the time, I was writing, like, fantasy and science fiction, which is great. And I love that people make that. But just the fact that what I'm writing could, like you said, inspire some kid to study science and create something that could change the world. I mean, that to me is just like, that's my dream at this point, is that will happen. Yeah.
Have you seen it happen yet?
No, I mean, unfortunately, I don't get a lot of feedback from my readers. So if it did happen, I don't know if I would know. Every once in a while, I'll get someone telling me that they liked what I wrote, but it doesn't happen as often as you might think. I don't know. They don't tend to seek out the author and tell them. But yeah, I know. I love when I get feedback from readers. It's fantastic. But yeah, I don't know. And this book's only been out for, you know, a couple months, so it hasn't had time to inspire anyone to do anything amazing. yeah, but I would hope that if someone was that inspired, they would tell me.
Yeah, I'm sure it does have an impact, even if it's not right away. I know that
yeah.
I have heard cool ideas from a friend, and they have suddenly become my idea. Mm-hmm. Like 12 months later, and I had no connection to the friend telling me this. So just having that raw knowledge in your head is really beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
And you can never really underestimate the power of adolescent inspiration.
Yes.
You know, you hear so many kids are like, oh, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And, you know, there's a lot of kids are like, oh, I want to be a superhero. I want to be Iron Man. I want to be Superman. Or I want to be a police officer. I want to be a firefighter. Yeah, cool. Awesome. But then there's always, in a group of kids, there's always that kid that's like, I want to be Neil deGrasse Tyson when I grow up. Or, you know, I've watched Cosmos as a kid and I want to be an astrophysicist. Or I think, you know, getting that inspiration, all you have to touch is one in 100,000.
Right.
And you build the next generation of people that are actively changing the world for the better.
Right.
So from my perspective, I just want to say thank you for writing this type of content. Yeah. And I think it's incredibly important for it to get disseminated and heard about and read and consumed.
Yeah.
Because it's arguably more important than people writing the books for the professionals.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
Who are actually doing the work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. The more general knowledge we can get out there about technology is the better. Definitely.
Yeah, and especially the kids. Ben, you make a great point that if there's another Neil deGrasse Tyson out there inspiring young people, like it can be cool to be a certain profession in different ages. But if as a kid you dream about being an AI scientist, I mean, that's awesome. And it'll stick with you for life, I feel like.
Yep. Yeah. And that's why in my book, I tried to really introduce as many different areas of science as I could, you know, and I wanted to bring kids, you know, parts of science that they'd never heard of. I wanted to share with them, you know, things that they maybe hadn't even realized were out there that they could get involved in. And hopefully something would spark their imagination or their inspiration and they'd want to learn more about it.
Yeah, on a fun note, anecdotally, that other chapter that you wrote, fusion research, that's what I have my undergrad in.
Oh, really?
I want to do instead of...
Oh, that's...
Yeah, I'm a nuclear... went to school for nuclear engineering.
Yeah.
But almost went and did grad study for fusion research. But yeah, it's fascinating. I think even though this podcast isn't about nuclear engineering and nuclear physics, I also enjoyed that. That's like, wow, this is actually somebody explaining this in a way that an intelligent young person could read and be like, oh, now I get it. It's not a bomb. We're taking two light molecules and subjecting them to intense, you know, heat and pressure, and they just do as the sun do and make a lot of energy. So yeah. Well done with that one as well.
Oh, thank you. That was actually a really cool experience that came out of writing the book, is that the fusion scientists that I interviewed invited me to their annual meeting and paid all my expenses and brought me there to sign books and taught. They brought in some kids from a local school. It was like the coolest thing ever. So that was very exciting for me, because I don't, you know, I do book events and stuff, but I had never been to a scientist conference because of one of my books. And that was, I was totally geeking out over it. Like, these are the people who are building these things and I'm getting to meet them, you know? So that was really fun.
I mean, hopefully you get an invitation to NIF, the National Ignition.
They did, actually. They said, if I'm ever there, I can go visit it, tour it. Yeah.
Nice.
I have an open invitation to NIF. I just don't know when I'm going to be in California, but hopefully I'll be able to do that at some point.
That and when ITER finally completes, I mean, I'm sure you wouldn't object to a vacation in the south of France.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember as a kid visiting CERN, and they had so many cool displays. It was like a Please Touch museum, but with physics, and it just blew my mind. I remember they had some, like a maglev train, but it was like a little ball, and it would spin around with some smoke coming out. And just things like that, like, you're so right. The young mind is so impressionable. And that's something I will never forget. I don't really know how it worked. I think I did at the time and then I forgot. But there's so much really cool display. Like, just kids are so impressionable. And reaching those audiences is super impactful. Mm-hmm. Sorry, sort of repeating
that's
what I
right.
said earlier.
Yeah.
But CERN is awesome.
Mm-hmm. It is.
All right. So... this was incredibly fun. I think we tackled some pretty weighty topics with the philosophy of society and ethics, but also it was great talking about how you're making this outreach, making an impact in the next generation of youth globally, about getting them inspired into... it's hard to get inspired about something that you don't understand, and you're right. helping people understand something and how exciting it actually can be. I think it's important what you're doing. I hope that you continue doing even more of it and delving even more into different realms of high-tech science that are going to be populating the world in the future with solutions. And it's going to need people that can. So yeah, thanks for coming on and having this chat.
Thank you guys. Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah, of course. So without further ado, I think that wraps up this episode. I'm Michael Burke.
And I'm Ben Wilson.
And I'm Catherine Hulick. Him.
We had a great talk, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Take it easy. See you next time.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.